Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
In our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with the director of the Cornell Institute for Translational Research on Aging, Dr. Carl Pillemer, about his book, 30 Lessons for Living, what he's learned from over 1,200 interviews with elders. I am so looking forward to this conversation.
I absolutely am too. But first, we've got some research that matters. And what we're talking about today, Adam, are a series of studies related to cancer care.
Yeah, this is a whole series of articles really looking at a whole different varieties of cancer care. And we thought we'd just really talk about them all at once because it helps us look at cancer care for patients who have really serious medical problems.
Thinking about the role of the primary care physician in the management of cancer.
Does it really matter if you have surgery from someone who collaborates or doesn't collaborate with other doctors?
What kinds of physicians discuss end-of-life issues?
And finally, what does it mean to really participate in a clinical trial with cancer? So really critical questions. So let's dive right in, Christy, and look at this very first research that was from the Annals of Surgical Oncology last year, looking at the treatment of cancer patients who are older and have other serious illnesses.
And what they found in looking at this, they were looking at recommendations for chemotherapy, for, you know, advanced colon cancer, for other curative surgeries, and trying to determine if there was variation based on how sick or how old the patient is. And they found that physicians tended to recommend these treatments for the younger and healthy patients and had more variation in recommending them for older and sicker patients.
Yeah, and when we think about it, a lot of the clinical trials, and we'll talk about this in a second, are really done on people who are younger and healthier, mm-hmm. and yet we're kind of extrapolating these results to patients who are older, sicker, and have many other problems, and that may not be totally fair.
Well, and they concluded that individual physicians that patients see may have that they do have an impact on the likelihood that an older, sicker patient will receive treatment. But, you know, I saw that too and thought, well, certain physicians who have deep relationships with their patients may be able to help them sort out better whether treatment is appropriate for them or what their values are versus, you know, managing symptoms rather than focusing on a curative treatment that might be less likely to be helpful if they're older and sicker. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right, Christy. I think, you know, this really requires much more that we really begin to really individualize treatment based upon your disease, your age, your comorbidities, your other
your
diseases
values.
You have, and your values. Yeah, great question. Let's talk about values. This next research that matters is actually from some research that was in the Journal of General Internal Medicine actually 2 years ago, but it really was important research that looked at, well, what is the role of you and I, primary care physicians, in the management of patients with cancer?
Well, and they were trying to figure out, you know, how many of cancer specialists involve primary care physicians and what that role is. And they found that more than 90% of primary care physicians reported filling at least one general medical care role in the care of cancer patients.
Well, and you know, I know you, Christy, like myself, have many patients with cancer and prostate cancer and colon. I mean, every cancer I'm thinking about. I don't think I've escaped one, unfortunately. And we know that, yeah, we manage a lot of times their underlying hypertension and their diabetes. But also it turns out that primary care doctors are managing a lot more than just these chronic diseases. They're managing things like depression or pain.
Yeah, and it's an important role that we fill. But also, I was pleased to see that determining treatment preferences and deciding on use of surgery were cancer roles that more than half of the primary care physicians were involved in. So, I mean, I have a bunch of patients that come to mind who will come to me after a diagnosis and after recommendations from the specialist to just sit down and talk about, okay, I got these different advice from different specialists or from different institutions and or, you know, trying to make decisions about do I go for the surgery? It sounds like a soft call. And the primary care physician can really be an advocate.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the take-home advice of this particular research is if you have a new diagnosis of cancer, your loved one, yes, you're going to see probably an oncologist or a surgeon, but also see your primary care doctor. Make an appointment because you want to clarify what the roles are. What do you really want for your primary care doctor to do? But they are a resource, support, your advocate, and can help empower you to make some maybe better decisions.
Absolutely.
What's our very next research that matters about the type of, does it matter if you have a surgeon that collaborates or doesn't collaborate? What does that mean?
Well, and so we think that collaborating among physicians leads to better outcomes. And so,
talking with other doctors or the primary care doctor and involving a team approach.
Exactly, a team approach. And so this was looking and showed that surgeons who have more high-volume surgeons that do a lot more cases in a given year were more likely to report actively collaborating with other physicians or the team approach in decisions about additional therapies with colorectal cancer in this case, suggesting that active collaboration among surgeons, you know, may lead to better outcomes and is also somehow influenced by the amount of volume.
This, you know, some research here from the Annals of Surgery, we've known that if you, in many things in medicine, if you go to someone who does it a lot, you may get better outcomes. Same here with surgery, but it's not just the fact they do it a lot, particularly in cancer care. It may be the fact that they're doing it in a way that allows them to bring others and other expertise into play here. It teases out a little bit what it really means to be high volume here. High volume mm-hmm. also means high collaboration. So a good question to maybe ask your surgeon, how likely or how easy can you collaborate with my primary care doctor and with the other specialists because I want a team approach to helping me figure out what's best for me?
Good advice. Okay, this is, next one is about physicians discussing end-of-life issues with terminally ill cancer patients. So we know that national guidelines recommend advanced care planning for patients who have a life expectancy of less than a year, and that doctors should be talking about this in the office before the last moments prior to passing away.
And in this research in the journal Cancer, appropriately named, they unfortunately found that, Christy, our colleagues don't seem to discuss end-of-life issues with those with terminal illness while they're feeling well and make the best time to perhaps make those discussions, but instead tend to put them off until our patients have more symptoms or maybe when there are no more treatments to offer. That seems a little late in the game that we should be having the conversation when people are well.
We absolutely should. And there are many reasons. We've talked on the show before, barriers with time and other pressures in the outpatient setting that might lead doctors to kind of put off that conversation. But I was pleased to see in the study that younger physicians, so the physicians that we are training, that we have trained recently.
They're doing better than we are.
They are. They're more likely to have discussions about end-of-life issues earlier. As well as were non-cancer specialists, meaning primary care doctors. So, you know, the folks we're training seem to be doing a better job. And I think it's because we've really highlighted the importance of having these conversations before those last moments.
Well, and I think this really shows as many of this research, Christy, the value of a primary care physician in the helping patients, even when they're dealing with cancer care that may not be the particular specialty domain of the primary care doctor, but you still need to have that expertise because it helps you make decisions that really are better for you. And what about our very last research that matters about decisions to participate in clinical trials?
And they're trying to sort out associations between physicians' personal and practice characteristics and their participation in clinical trials.
Yeah, in this particular one, we know that a lot of providers don't refer their patients to clinical trials like at the National Cancer Institute or ones that are done in academic medical centers. And they were hoping to discover, well, why is it that maybe more physicians don't refer these patients or maybe patients don't want to go to these clinical trials? And you know, I wasn't so certain, Christy, that this that they didn't maybe miss part of the boat here, which is that maybe providers really are aware of the clinical trials and patients are aware that these are available, but maybe choose not to do that.
Yeah, I think, you know, they sort of talk about it as if the goal is more people doing clinical trials.
Which we do need for research purposes, but it's not as if that these don't have cost in terms of leaving your home or time or possible side effects. I mean, these are all serious issues, and I'm hoping people already have those conversations. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the goal is not totally having more numbers in the clinical trials necessarily, but having the right people involved in those clinical trials where that really could be helpful or maybe one of the only outcomes for them of hope for a cure or the right people who are willing to and excited to participate in that sort of thing. So, yeah, I would question some of the goals of that, but we do know that clinical trials can be very helpful. Certainly
advancing the research. Listen, I've got a lot of patients, you do too, with pancreatic or ovarian cancer. If it weren't for the clinical trials right now, there wouldn't be a whole lot of hope in some respects. So important research journal, National Cancer Institute. And Christy, I hope that this focus on some of these questions that this new cancer research brings up are things that are helpful to our listeners.
I hope so as well. Certainly interesting in our discussion. And I'm grateful, you know, we didn't mention our own cancer hospital at UNC, but I am grateful that we do work in a place that collaborates well with us as primary care physicians and within their interdisciplinary team.
And these are the
team.
Types of questions you can bring up with any of your cancer providers because we hope that it will lead to better care for you. Well, that will conclude the Research That Matter portions of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Carl Pillemer about his book, 30 Lessons for Living. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golsey and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we are going to talk with professor and director of the Cornell Institute for Translational Research on Aging, Dr. Carl Pillemer, about his book, 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans. Adam and I are excited to have this conversation and want to welcome you, Dr. Pillemer.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be here, and thanks so much for having me.
Well, Dr. Pillemer, let's just dive right into this topic, which is, how did you become passionate about talking to elders? Isn't something that people are born with, I don't think.
It is. Well, you know, I could stretch it back to having grown up with two very powerful grandmothers in my life.
Uh-huh.
You know, but I would say that, you know, the genesis behind this project, the overall project, is of a legacy project at Cornell. And the book, 30 Lessons for Living, I'd say there were two things that really led me to get interested in this. The first is that it struck me that Americans have an insatiable hunger for advice, and, you know, like such that $1 billion a year is spent on advice books, but almost all of them are written by sort of not credible experts, pop psychologists and motivational speakers, et cetera. And it seemed to me that, you know, we had this untapped source of interesting advice for living, which was people essentially 70 and above. I'd say the other piece of it, though, was as a gerontologist, I found that my own work over 25 years had bought into something I think our society does as a whole, and that's to treat older people as problems to be solved. So I'd worked on elder abuse and nursing home residents and Alzheimer's disease, and I wanted to do a project that really saw older people as resources rather than problems. So I'd say those were two. I'll say perhaps just one last one. I also became aware of an interesting body, and now it's still growing, of social science research that shows that people in their 70s and beyond are happier than younger people, have higher life satisfaction in spite of health problems and loss. So it seemed to me there might be something older people know that younger people don't, and I kind of wanted to see what that was and try to get it out to younger people.
Well, and I love that concept of helping, of seeing elders as resources, but helping the elders themselves just see the value in their life and to be able to pass that down. You know, in thinking just about American culture while we're on that topic, you know, one of the things I've learned from various places that I've traveled is, you know, the differences that we have as Americans in how we treat and respect and care for our elderly family members, and how different that is than what a lot of countries do. What do you think about our culture and the respect that we have for the advice of our elders? Obviously, you must have thought that people would want to read your book.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, I will say that many of the 1,200 respondents in 30 Lessons for Living were actually kind of, they really wanted to give their advice, but they were very surprised to think that younger people would be interested. And, you know, I think really what you point to is a serious problem in American society, probably Western society as a whole, and that's the incredible degree to which it is segregated by age, even more so than it is by race. You know, I give the example, how many 29-year-old guys invite a 74-year-old over for pizza and beer and watch the football game? You know, it seems almost absurd, but that's how segregated our society is by age, and we don't have these natural contacts. I think in indigenous cultures, you certainly see a stronger connection. But it's also true in Western society up until about 100 years ago. You know, the only person who there was to go to for advice was the older person was the oldest person you knew. And that advice was key to human survival. So it does seem to me like we've lost touch with that pretty substantially.
You know, I guess it would be worthwhile for us to really dive a little bit into some of the things you've learned. I mean, I know that one of my closest friends since I came to Chapel Hill actually was a retired urologist who I became very close to initially as a friend, then as a patient, and then back again as a friend. And I learned lots of lessons from him. And I'm wondering, are the lessons I learned the ones that you learned from talking with lots of seniors? What did you learn?
You know, that's also a great question. And I think almost all of us have a few of those figures in our lives. And so what I wanted to do by doing surveys of so many older people was to try to take advantage of the wisdom of crowds, so to speak, and really be able to draw out these main themes.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, the lessons are organized into six major themes. So work and career, family, child rearing, and several others.
Let's pick one of those to start with. Let's pick parenting. Tell us what the elders, what did you learn from their interviews about parenting?
Absolutely. And let me say, you know, I was worried about parenting because I thought I would just get a bunch of cliches, you know, like love your kids or be firm or something like that.
Or go so fast.
Exactly.
Glad they're gone. No.
Well, actually, there's quite a bit of that because these relationships do improve, actually, often after the children leave the household. I'd say there were several main lessons. I'll give you a big picture one and a smaller picture one. The biggest picture one is the view from 80, 90, 100. My oldest interviewee was 108.
Wow.
Is that people have to acknowledge that relationships with their children are going to last for a much longer time after the children depart the household. So because of the increased lifespan, people can look forward to 30, 40, 50, or 60 years of shared lifetime with parents as adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really want people to think, you know, like when your kids are 5 and 10, what are you doing right now so these kids are going to want to be around you and support you and be part of your life when you're 70? And one of their pieces of advice, which really struck me, had to do with parental favoritism.
Mm.
So one of the lessons in the book, and it's one of the strongest ones that is, you know, argued by most people, is that you should accept the fact that you have favorites among your children. That is, it's almost inevitable that you may like one more than another. And you should take those feelings and bury them deep and never let anybody know it. So it's a double-edged sword. And one of the things I will say, some of the most emotional interviews I had were older people in their 80s or 90s talking about how horrible it was to be treated differentially by their parents or to have a parent who treated them much worse.
So it's key to, as a parent from these elders, to treat your children equally despite how you may feel.
Absolutely.
And to make that explicit, and to make it explicit, and to make it explicit to the children that you're doing that?
You know, they really hope that your kids simply won't be aware of any feelings or favoritism you may have. Let me toss another quick one out to you, which actually really surprised me. I assumed that this would be the spare the rod and spoil the child generation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lessons was very definitively don't hit your kids. That they either have extremely bad memories of growing up with harsh physical punishment, or they used it on their kids and it didn't work. So there was a very strong sentiment against the corporal punishment of children. And folks might think that's outmoded, but studies show that most parents do actually hit their kids.
Fascinating, because you would think, from my perspective, you know, that's sort of the wave of the current parenting thinking of, you know, there's a lot more more controversy about corporal punishment or about any spanking. And you might wonder if there are cultural differences between our current generation, which may have mixed feelings about spanking your children, compared with the generation that you interviewed, maybe thinking that their thoughts are not applicable. But in this case, it sounds like it's the exact opposite of what we might have judged them to think.
You know, I found that again and again, you know, that even in some of the more straightforward lessons, one of the beauties of this combined elder wisdom is that it comes up over and over against sort of common wisdom or conventional thinking, and sometimes it's a little to the left of it, and sometimes it's a little to the right. But looking at these combined themes was often very surprising. You're right.
Well, you know, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we really want to continue this conversation and look at some of the things that the elders told you about marriage and about career and maybe about life lessons overall. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Carl Pillemer about 30 lessons for living, tried and true advice from the wisest Americans. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and the NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Carl Pillemer about 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans, a new and important book that he has just published.
Yeah, and in all of your interviews with patients, I'm really interested in hearing more about what they summed up about happiness. And one of the quotes that I found really striking was one that says, "In my 89 years, I've learned that happiness is a choice and not a condition." It really struck me just because that's my upbringing. You know, I hear my mother say that almost every week about something or another. And it's been something that I've used in teaching doctors who go through their training and are sort of struggling with cynicism or struggling with sort of developing themselves professionally, and the power of making some of those choices, not necessarily in the context of major depression, but in making some choices about happiness. But how does that tie into the wisdom of this really important group?
You know, that's such a great question. And just, you know, I think there's one thing we have to step back and say, if we ask the question, what makes older people really different from younger people? And I'm in my mid-50s, so I mean me and younger. Of course, one is the very different historical experiences, because most of them have lived through poverty to extreme poverty, difficult jobs, the war years. So one thing which they are particularly good experts on is living well through hard times.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of them have developed a perspective over the course of their lives, which they believe isn't unique to old people. They believe that younger people could also have it, that happiness is not something which occurs because of things. It's something that occurs in spite of things because you choose to be happy.
Is this what you talk about as acceptance?
Right. In part, it's acceptance, and it's also active, I would say, too. You know, and I think this notion, which you mentioned, that happiness is a choice and not a condition. People told me over and over that life involves hard times. And that the answer to that is to make a conscious daily choice to be happy in spite of loss, health problems, or a financial difficulty. And it's not just a platitude for them. You know, they've actually done it. This is where I think they're such credible experts. I'll give you one example. I'm a huge worrier, so I'm sort of a Woody Allen, you know, type. You know, like I could list every morning things to worry about.
You just created some images, okay.
And they have a very striking lesson, and a nearly unanimous one. It's going to sound simple. They have a radical view of worry. They really want younger people to stop worrying. And in the chapter on regret, a major regret expressed by them is not having an affair or a bad business deal. It's time wasted worrying about things that never happened.
Huh.
So looking back from the end of life, they have this radical view of worry. As one told me, worry wastes your life. And they give readers specific tips. But what I think is really useful to me, to others who've read the book, hearing people say this from their 80s, 90s, and beyond, that what you're really going to regret is poisoning your current daily life, you know, with needless worry about the future. Somehow it just grips you more than reading it in a typical self-help book, I guess. And it certainly did do that for me. I think my kids say I don't worry so much about them as I used to.
You know, I remember my father of blessed memory who used to tell me when I would bring up issues that were happening in the world around me, it could be my own world or the greater, and he would say, you know, Adam, worry about things that you can do something about. And I reflected, and I find myself giving that advice now because it seems to focus me. I don't worry so much about things I really can't change or that don't really involve me. And I thought, what powerful advice, but it seems as if this is part of what the elders are able to impart.
Well, you know, I think it is, and I think, you know, the other piece of what they have that younger people don't, that I think really relates to what you're saying, is that, you know, they have a limited time horizon. Now, of course, all of us have a limited time horizon, but I found that the older the respondent, the more likely they were to say that life has passed by very quickly. So the insight life is short is one that they would really like younger people to know, not to depress them, but to help them make better decisions, you know, to savor daily life. One of their lessons is to say things which need to be said while people are still alive. And they bring an intensity to that. Because honestly, they have a relatively short period of time. About a quarter of the 1,200 people I started interviewing in 2004, you know, have already passed away.
Wow, and they gave this important contribution to the rest of us before they passed. That's really powerful. I'm curious, as a woman trying to work and have children and figure out this life-work balance thing, and in that journey, what did you learn from them?
Well, this is the one thing I'm afraid that people aren't going to like as much. But I did promise the people I interviewed to give their lessons as they said them. So a very strong point, you know, they have about child rearing is they believe that time spent with children, the physical amount of time, is something of a magic bullet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you can do anything, it's to spend more time with your children. And if you're already spending time with them, to spend more time with them. And they look back at their own thousands of years of child-rearing experience altogether, plus their own upbringings. And they really believe that both men and women should sacrifice to have more time with their children. So I think, you know, they view families as being out of balance and not being able to provide as much time as is needed.
But don't,
you know, the other piece of it, they, you know, I thought this generation who'd grown up in the Great Depression would say, work as hard as you can to be as financially secure as possible. In fact, you know, their view is very different. Really, they, you know, feel that you should use your lifetime for things like family and relationships and not spend it earning extra money that you may not need.
Mm-hmm.
So they were surprisingly non-materialistic. And I take from that a sense, you know, that families ought to spend more time with kids and with one another, you know, rather than simply making extra money for luxuries. And that really is one of the lessons in the book.
Well, no one can argue with that. It's beautiful.
Well, and there are a lot of families, though, in today who aren't having children and marriages. So for those who didn't have children or for whom that the or married or single, was it different sorts of advice because they didn't have these children to have a centerpiece?
Well, a great piece of advice is they argue, and again, surprising for this generation, they argue so strongly against rushing into marriage. This is one of their key lessons for avoiding regret. And they argue that both men and women shouldn't feel bad about never getting married if it's not right for them, because they've seen so many unhappy marriages.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of endorsement from people who'd never married and never had kids. I'll tell you one thing. The research also supports this. You know, it shows that people over their life course who are childless are as happy as people who have children. So, you know, there is a sense from the elders that it's perfectly fine if people choose a single lifestyle and don't have kids. I mean, they clearly view that as very enriching, but they would much rather have people not enter into unsatisfying relationships. You know, the other piece I would say is they really argue that people throughout the life course ought to learn to be more social, and especially when you hit, you know, the 60s, 70s, and beyond, that even if you're an introvert, you know, you should learn to be social. So I think they see that as compensating for a loss or lack of relationships.
What about differences in your responses from people who had different ethnic, cultural, spiritual, or economic backgrounds?
Or sexual.
You know, there wasn't a lot of sexual diversity in the sample, although there were some gay elders. You know, that was definitely underrepresented. Otherwise, though, one component of the study was a true national random sample survey, you know, where every older person in the country had an equal chance of being selected. And that was very economically and racially diverse. You know, I would say that the overall lessons, the core lessons, were very, very similar, regardless of income, a geographic location, and race. However, the life experiences were quite different. So, for example, African Americans, and there's some of this in the book, obviously suffered incredible discrimination. I interviewed one of the Tuskegee Airmen, for example.
Oh, wow.
You know, who's profiled in the book and talks about his experience. But their methods of dealing with it, and their lessons for overcoming adversity were actually very similar. So even though
don't worry, acceptance, savoring, those things.
I would say yes. However, there is absolutely with them a sense of saying yes to opportunity. You know, taking an active role, and this notion of learning how to be happy and satisfied with life. You know, despite the problems which might occur to you. So I think, you know, that is really, you know, sort of all part of the whole. But, yeah, it was a diverse sample, but I was quite surprised at how similar these core lessons for living were.
You know, Dr. Pelmer, we are going to need to take a break and wrap up this segment, but we'll stick around for a few more questions on Behind the Scenes that people can access on the website and through iTunes. But where can people get information about your book? Where can people buy your book?
Absolutely.
I want to buy it.
Well, thanks. It's available in almost all bookstores, and people can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and simply input 30 Lessons for Living with the number 30. We also have a website, and if people look on a search engine for the Cornell Legacy Project, you can enter your own life lessons there, and maybe it'll involve itself in another book.
Well, you know, we're sitting here also looking at a picture of you from that your publicist sent us, and you look happy.
And so, you've chosen the right thing.
we want to thank you for being our guest, sharing your work and doing the work that you did to share your interviews with the elders, to share with us and our listeners. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Well,
thank you.
It's been a real pleasure and a great show.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For our House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments, questions, stories to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to answer a few questions from our listeners. We've got some good ones today about side effects from an ACE inhibitor and a medicine called an ARB.
About people who had pneumonia and how when they have to get re-examined.
About a cyst on the testicle. And about mold in an apartment.
Well, let's listen to our very first question.
I have a question for your health. I was given an ACE inhibitor for my blood pressure recently, and I developed a cough. My doctor said it was pretty rare, and they put me on a medicine called an ARB. I also developed a cough, and my doctor said he did not think it was due to the medicine this time, but it appears that the ARB medicines can also cause a cough. When I stopped the ARB, my cough went away. Do you think this is related?
You know, that's something that we haven't talked about on the show really before, Christy, which is we do talk about side effects of medicines, but this cough that is a frequent side effect of a medicine called an ACE inhibitor for high blood pressure, but can you get it from other types of medicines?
Yeah. So when people are on something called an ACE inhibitor, about 20% of people will get this sort of dry cough. Some people notice it. Some people are bothered by it enough to stop the medicine. And in that case, we often will switch over to a very similar medicine called an ARB, A-R-B, very similar medicine that also protects the kidneys and lowers the blood pressure. And thinking that, well, it has this one pathway that makes it so you don't get the cough.
And it turns out that there's pretty good research that the rate of cough with the ARB is significantly less than the ACE inhibitor for high blood pressure. So doctors a lot of times will switch patients from an ACE if they develop the cough to the ARB. But it raises an interesting question, Christy. Why don't we just put patients on the ARBs to start with?
Well, because there's a lot more evidence and research on the ACE, for one. And in historical times, you could get an ACE inhibitor for a lot cheaper than you could get an ARB. But now we've got ARBs that are generic and on the $4 list. So that's changed the times, I think, a little bit. But
good points. Excellent points.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam.
You're welcome.
And in your case, can the ARB have caused your cough? Well, you know, sure. It's possible. It's less likely than with an ACE inhibitor, for sure. And I think you have to sort of weigh out based on your other reasons for needing that medicine. Like, do you have diabetes or other reasons why that is a good choice for you? If the cough that you attribute to the medicine, if that bothers you enough to choose a different blood pressure medicine. So that's something to weigh out carefully with your doctor.
Hope that's provided you some answers, and let's take a listen to our very next house call.
Hi, I'm 51 and healthy my whole life. I recently had a scary episode of pneumonia and was pretty sick. With antibiotics, I got better. When I got a copy of the x-ray report, it said I should get a follow-up x-ray in a couple of weeks to make sure everything's okay. My doctor said that I would be okay since I improved. But another friend of mine advised me to get the follow-up x-ray. What do y'all think? Why or why not?
Sounds really scary to have pneumonia and to be just what sounds like totally healthy and then get that sick.
Well, and we've seen a lot of pneumonia. I have. I know you have, Christy, in our hospital and in our inpatient service as an outpatient among friends. This is potentially a difficult issue this winter, and as it is in many winters with flu and pneumonia.
And, you know, the decision of to repeat an x-ray, usually this is based on clinical decision-making. So if your symptoms are better, your lung exam is better, your vitals are better, and everything sounds better from your physician's perspective, then a decision to not repeat that x-ray may be reasonable. But there may be instances where it would be helpful.
Yeah, and I guess it would be hard for us to know without really knowing your situation.
Right, are you a smoker?
And this is your primary care. Absolutely. Are you a smoker? Have you had some underlying disease of the lungs like sarcoidosis or something else? Or are you really, really worried? And sounds like the radiologist was worried. You were pretty sick. You can paint a story here, a narrative that would have us kind of worried. And, you know, following up with an x-ray to make sure it's gone away, it probably won't hurt you.
It probably won't over time. If you kept doing that all the time, there's radiation risk, but a single x-ray, probably not that big of a deal. So I would talk to your doctor about it. If you're not comfortable about his recommendation to not have the x-ray, then have that conversation about what the benefits would be for you.
This is one of those situations where everyone could be right.
Exactly.
Your doctor's right, you're right.
Sorry,
and the person
says
you don't need it's right.
Yeah, we are straddling the fence on that one. Okay, let's hear the next house call.
I was recently told that I had a cyst on my epididymis. What is the epididymis, and should I be concerned? I have heard some cysts around the testicles can be cancerous or cause infertility.
A cyst on your epididymis. Those rhyme, but those are not things that I don't think are easy for to both bring as questions to us, which we appreciate, but those are scary things when you get some sort of lesion on your testicle. As a man, you worry about testicular cancer.
Sure. And And in this case, you ask, what is the epididymis and what is a cyst on it? You know, this is usually a smooth, firm lump in the scrotum that's sort of at the top of the testicle, which is where your epididymis is. And you can get a sperm-filled cyst there called an epididymal cyst or a spermatocele. And thankfully, it's not harmful to you.
No, we don't know what causes it, but it doesn't cause symptoms. So the nice thing is, if you were actually having symptoms and pain, it probably is not a spermatocele. The other good news is it doesn't cause problems with infertility. So we don't worry about it, and we usually recommend that you don't do anything about it.
A doctor can diagnose this in the office, use like shining a light through it to see. There's a certain way that it lights up differently when it's a cyst like that. But you're right to think, you know, to make sure that it's not testicular cancer, which would be usually on the actual testicle and not in that little space where the doctor's feeling it. And there is something called a varicocele, where you get sort of a bag of worms feeling adjacent to your testicle that can be related to fertility. So kind of teasing out what the situation is with your doctor is the right thing to do.
And a safe, easy thing, if there's any question, is an ultrasound.
Yep.
Can reassure you and your doctor that you're not dealing with something dangerous.
Yep.
So this is one of those things that we encourage any man who has a lump on their testicle that they're not sure of or is new, do get it evaluated, because we can hopefully prevent any serious diseases.
Yeah, if it is testicular cancer, it's one of the few cancers that
we can treat and cure. Absolutely. Let's listen to our very last house call now.
I moved into a new apartment, and almost immediately I noticed that I started having sinus problems and headaches. I believe it is coming from the air filters and air system in the apartment building that is old and moldy. I asked my doctor for a letter indicating that my exposure to mold could be causing problems, but he seemed dubious. What do you all think?
You know, I've heard this from patients that moving into a different apartment or concerns about mold triggering allergy symptoms being a problem. And I've had patients ask me to write these letters. And it is hard because it's not as easy to just say, yes, A caused B.
And you can get out of your security deposit and any rent obligations potentially. I mean, that's what a lot of times is behind some of this, right?
Right.
So what do you do, Christy?
Well, I try to tease out the timing of your symptoms. What exactly are your symptoms? What have you tried to make it better? A little bit more about the environment and your concerns. If they're severe, you can go see an allergist who could test you for certain reactions that your body has to different molds and other things in the environment. But in the end, if the story sounds reasonable, then I write that letter.
Yeah, I write that frequently because it's a hard thing to really prove unless you have other data. And I'm not sure that it's our responsibility to be the ones to be decided. But I will write clearly that this particular listener feels that their problems are coming from
right.
this. And I can sign that because that's what I'm hearing.
Right. Exactly. So you word it in a way that's not like absolutely that things cause damage forever, but, you know, word it in a way that, you know, it's
plausible.
They're
going to use me to shut down this apartment.
Right. Exactly. It's a hard line to walk.
Yeah.
But we both advocate for our patients but also have to be ethical in those letters.
Well, that will conclude our house calls, but we've had a good chance to talk about maybe how we can respond or not respond to concerns about environmental issues.
To concerns about cysts on the testicle.
Yep, to pneumonia and maybe following up x-rays clinically or with another x-ray.
And about coughs that can come with certain blood pressure medications.
Well, thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important. You can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at Your Health Radio. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Thank you. And our guest today, Dr. Carl Pillemer. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.